country. So they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide-and-rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowroz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Nowroz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowroz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowroz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowroz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowroz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods. And you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowroz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowroz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowroz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Nowroz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24 a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram, and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal. I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The Holy Month of Mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time more specifically. Volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So Sa'ad Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken, and now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're gonna put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country. United against all the odds, they strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth. That I bear art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal. And thy word has no failing nor any change. And the Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In 73 days of U.S.-Israeli genocide, confirmed by U.N. experts, over 32,500 murdered, over 100 deaths repeatedly occurring during 24-hour time spans. Yet one of the only achievements of the so-called international community is for the U.S. to abstain from a resolution for a temporary ceasefire instead of a veto, widening the U.S.-Israeli spat. Ceasefire talks have hit a dead end, one after another, with each side blaming the other, though it is clear that the Israeli regime is the one committing the genocide. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at things like Israel's international isolation, humanitarian issues like the controversial U.S. airdrops, amongst many others, and the Yemeni army's continued targeting of Israeli-bound vessels, including ones from the U.S. and the U.K. First, let me introduce our guests. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, joins us from occupied Ramallah. Also joining us is Fahima Mohammed, who's a broadcaster and TV presenter from London. Welcome to you both. Saad Nimr, let me first start with you and get your reaction on what the UN expert Albanese said. She's a UN special rapporteur on the rights situation in the Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese. Quote, there are reasonable grounds to believe that Israel has committed the crime of genocide against Palestinians. Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Well, that was this morning in the session of the United Nations Security Council, as well as the United Nations General Assembly in many cases, and on that it was also in Palestine. And she addressed the audience with this statement. It is about time. Now, when we are talking about organizations, most of the organizations around the world are admitting that there is a genocide in many accounts, not only three as she mentioned, but even more. But this is a view of their investigation to talk about, you know, three kinds of genocide and war crimes in Gaza. Everyone knows now, and even after the ICC also ruling about, you know, the Israelis that should commit and not to commit any kind of genocide. It is a kind of admission that there is a kind of genocide going on, and now we are waiting to see what would do follow in the ICC. However, it's not now about that the whole world do know that there is a genocide and there is war crimes one after another in every day on a daily basis. It's not that the most important thing. The most important thing, what the international community or so-called international community going to do. They are doing nothing apart from, you know, these statements. We heard many statements from so many people in positions, including Guterres himself. But so far, there is no action being taken in order to stop Israel from this genocide or to force Israel to stop the genocide and the war crimes committed against the Palestinians.
Well, Fahima Mohammed, one of the things that occurred was at the UNSC. Well, for the first time, there was a Gaza ceasefire resolution. This was because the U.S. abstained. There were previous attempts where the U.S. vetoed. But some are saying that's a little too late. It's just a political win where it emphasizes and kind of puts weight on what our guest there from Ramallah said, that these are just statements and words overall. I mean, we're looking at 32,000 Palestinians that have been killed. First of all, why do you think the U.S. went for that? And if you think it's too late for something like that, in this stage, at this stage of the game, and if there is a ceasefire, then why aren't other countries moving to implement it and doing something about it?
I think, in addition to what our guests have just mentioned, I think everyone can see now that in the context, there have been several international laws and principles that have been violated. And because also the journalists are still not allowed into Israel to actually comment and counter whatever has been done. So then it only is left for people to understand that what they've been seeing is the violence, which is continued attacks on the civilians, the infrastructure, the hospitals, which is the international human rights law. Then we've got the Geneva Conventions as well. The fourth Geneva Convention addresses the protection of civilians at the times of war. And as we can see, that it basically has got nothing that they are doing in attempt to actually save or, you know, give them any sort of way out of Rafah when there are statements directly from Netanyahu to actually enter. So these are another violation of these provisions, which is evident, and people are very concerned. We've also got the UN Charter, which prohibits the threat and use of force against territorial integrity or political independence of any state. So the aggression, as again, is continuous. And then we've got the customary international law, again, which in the Palestinian context prohibits, you know, genocide. And with the UN now stating that, of course, there are evidence for that. And again, the international criminal law stating the genocide being accountable under this international criminal law includes the deliberate targeting of civilians and systematic violence. So I guess these kind of adoption and principles are now being seen worldwide, and the pressure politically is definitely there, but nobody's implementing it because it's always been lip service. And the port that's been built is even made from the rubble. So they are trying different ways, and even UN spokesmen have said that they are, you know, trucks miles away, you know, basically there to give the aid, but just not being entered. So again, we can see that there is still support for the continuous bombardment and genocide that's happening, and nobody is actually taking any action, like you said. And the reasons being is because there's probably too much at stake for what is the end goal and their own propaganda and agenda for the actual land in Gaza.
Indeed. Well, we're looking now at what appears to be this rift, said number, which has different dimensions to it. I'm not too sure if we can call it a rift, because in words, it's one thing, in action, it's another. But one aspect of it is this U.S. abstention, where it is pretty significant in terms of the way that that has not only been done, but the way it has impacted this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. What do you think about that? Because we hear, of course, the delegation that was canceled by Israel to travel to the U.S., even though their military chiefs did meet. Netanyahu also said this cancellation is a message to Hamas in terms of the way we are dealing with the U.S. But nonetheless, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think that the United States were sending a message also to Israel by this, situation in the Security Council. And particularly this message is to Netanyahu. It's quite clear that now there is a kind of a campaign in the United States to separate between Israel and the relationship between the United States and Israel, which is a solid kind of relationship, and they are committed to Israel, and they are going to continue supporting Israel. Today there was a meeting, to discuss the operation to Rafah. So the Americans are still participating in this war, and they are again going on with Israel on the strategic level. However, there are some problems between the administration and Netanyahu or the government of Israel. What the Americans are trying now to do by meeting Gallant alone and meeting Gantz alone, ministers in the government or the Israeli government, it means that they are trying, to push down Netanyahu, and they are saying quite clearly that it's Netanyahu is acting on his own interest rather than the interest of Israel. They are still committed to help Israel and to support Israel in all accounts, but at the same time, they want to send this message to Netanyahu, knowing by the end of the day that even this resolution being taken yesterday, it's not going to be implemented, because Israel is not going to implement it. When did Israel implement any of the United Nations resolutions? We are talking about more than 1,000 resolutions in between the Security Council and the General Assembly, and Israel did not comply with even one single resolution. So the Americans do know that, and they know that they are going to support them if there were some pressure going on by other countries, like the today Colombian president said that we should start boycotting Israel if they did not comply with the resolution. This is a good gesture by the Colombian president, but at the same time, let's see other countries what they are going to do and how they are going to implement and force Israel to cease fire and so stop this aggression and this genocide against the Palestinians. I think that the Americans and Israeli do know that Israel is not going to comply.
Well, here's the problem. I don't know if you may see it this way or not, Fahima Mohammed, is the fact that you have the U.S. all-out support when this Operation Oslo Flood started. You have these four previous times that they came and they used their veto. But each time that they're doing that, you have hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that are being murdered, finally getting to the point where they abstain. And then you have, for example, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, saying civilian death toll is far too high and the amount of aid is way too low, far too low. Palestinians are dying as a result. And our guests there said the U.S. is continuing with its support. Palestinians are dying. People are losing their lives. This, if you take that out of the context of what's happening, that's what the end result is. There needs to be a way to speed things up. How do you see it?
I just think it's just showing and highlighting the U.S. hypocrisy in Gaza, the U.S. Secretary of Defense's acknowledgement of civilian casualties and insufficient humanitarian aid in Gaza highlights a discrepancy between the rhetoric and action, and the continued military support to Israel amid civilian casualties raises questions about the U.S. policy coherence and commitment to human rights principles. And I think that at the end of the day, it's a political battle as well with regards to the upcoming elections, as well as in the U.S., as well as in the U.K. And I think a lot of people are just trying to submit to some of the narratives that people are, abiding by, the uproar of the protests. And obviously, most people are now on the side of the Palestinians. So they just saying what they need to say, but in the end, the action is definitely not there. And again, it's no point delivering and surrounding all this aid. And at the same time, the aid is actually killing some of the civilians as well while they're distributing it off the air. And at the same time, facilitating and delivering to ensure that they are still providing the military aid. So it's very much a hypocrisy. We'll be right back.
is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's take a look at these controversial airdrops, said number, which is another controversy, where you have 18 people who have drowned, several killed in stampedes, from what we understand. Again, it goes back to the fact that you have the airdrops, which shows the U.S. intention that it actually cares, but yet you have supplies, arms, et cetera, that are being military supplied to the Israeli regime.
And I think that this is, you know, the biggest scam we ever heard of by the United States and Israel. Israel will allow Jordanian, Emiratis, and American aeroplanes to fly over Israel to send aid to Gaza, but the American can't pressurize the Israelis to open the gates and the crossings, especially not only Rafah, but we are talking about, you know, more than five crossings between Israel and Gaza, which they used to bring goods through it, more than 500 trucks every day. That was before the 7th of October. Now, America can't even open one or two of those crossings and allow more aid to get in, especially that the aid is piling up in on the other side of the Rafah crossings in Egypt. So it's already there, but the access is not there because of the Israeli regulations and the Israeli, you know, banning of the aid to come into Gaza. Now the Americans are sending these kind of airdrops, but at the same time they can't force the Israelis to open one of those crossings. It's unbelievable. I think it is a kind of a scam, or the Americans want to show around the world that we are trying our best and we are helping in, you know, getting food to the Palestinians who are starving and dying of starvation, especially north of Gaza. And we are doing our best in the humanitarian issue. And they are trying, you know, to show that they are these kind of good guys. At the same time, they are the one who are giving the Israeli the ammunition and giving them the rockets and giving them the all kind of supplies of to continue this war. And we know that they can stop the war, and we know that they can force Israel to open more crossings. So I think the whole thing is just, you know, a kind of a charade in front of the international community to say that we are doing our best, and in the future they will say we helped, we tried, right, and we gave them, you know, some food here and there by air droppings.
Okay, this rift thing between the U.S. and Israel, however, in one respect seems to be serious, Fahima, where we take a look at, for example, how there was a news source a week or more ago that said this military operation in Rafah, were Israel to go ahead with it, would lead to a shift in U.S. policy. We're looking at one shift that happened at the U.N., the other being the military assistance yearly of the U.S. to Israel. If we've seen the shift at the U.N., do you think the other is going to come?
I think the potential shift in U.S. policy is possibly a significant shift in U.S. policy in response to just Israel military operations in Rafah, reflects the growing international scrutiny of Israel's actions and their consequences, not necessarily what they actually would really do. So conditioning of military assistance could serve as a leverage point for influencing Israel's behavior. But again, to what extent do they have that power over Israel? Or are they still just, again, it's lip service, smoking screens? And again, just like our guest has mentioned, it's just, you know, saying and covering themselves to say we have tried our best so that they are not held accountable, but in the end, they have no control over Israel to make them do whatever they're doing. They're just only there as an ally to give whatever support and at the same time to cover themselves when it comes to any kind of future international kind of criminal investigation. And I think that's what they are actually doing. But obviously, there is so much that can be done that they're not doing. And it's not just the allies, it's also the surrounding countries as well. So there has to be accountability and responsibility, not just for the Western world, but also in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, talking about surrounding countries and this criminal proceedings that may actually involve other countries, there has been a somewhat of a contagion when it comes to stopping arms shipments to the Israeli regime. Canada has halted the arms sales to Israel. Side number, we're looking at Denmark and Italy to have already suspended their arms exports. The Netherlands maybe has ruled the government to do the same. British Parliament, for example, some parliamentarians are calling on the government to put an end, even though the number of MPs is still not enough. What do you think about this trend? Do you think that this is something that's going to involve other countries as well?
Yeah, I think that the public in Europe and in other countries around the world who were going into demonstrations in support of Palestine and try to put an end to the Israeli aggression started to get some results here and there. Well, if you remember, we talked about many times about, you know, the results of this war, and we said there are some changes occurring, and we said that changes on the international level, it will be slow a little bit, but sometimes it might be even much better. Now, I think few countries are starting, you know, to take some actions, and I believe this is a turning point, important point, for the future, to get out from the circle of America, because we know that the Europeans generally, and European Union as an organization in itself, they follow the Americans totally, and they agree with what the Americans are doing and the policies of America, whatever. So to see that few countries here and there is starting to act alone, and now we are hearing also that there are few countries in Europe who are willing to start and initiate recognition of Palestine as a full state. And that is also important, and they are breaking away from the mainstream policies of United States. Yeah, it is the pressure of the people. It's the pressure of the people which, you know, get these governments to start, you know, thinking differently. That might, you know, make the changes on a longer term, not on a short term. Short term, we can see only these few countries here and there who are willing, you know, to do something and to take action. But I was also amazed today with 120 parliamentarians in UK taking this decision, you know, or talking about, you know, stop sending weapons to Israel. Though, as you said, it's not enough, but at least this is a great move which we never anticipated before. Canada, which is an important ally to the United States, Italy, Spain. Okay. So we are talking about few countries, even in Europe or even in America, North America, they are trying, you know, to get somewhere, because the pressure is coming from their own public, and this pressure was a genuine one and really a big one, and it started to do some effect. We hope that other sure. countries also will follow in the same lines.
There are some questions about whether this is just, again, to impress the international community, because some of these export permits is said the approval prior to January 8th will still go through with them being delivered. Nonetheless, because of lack of time, we need to move to the successful campaign that the Yemenis have executed. Fahima Mohammed, if you can tell us about the way that this has actually surprised many, and it does remain a successful campaign, and unfortunate that Yemen is one of the only Arab countries to really stepped up to the plate and done what it has. What's your impression of the way that they've gone about this?
Yes, the Yemeni army's targeting of vessels bound for countries supporting the Saudi-led coalition reflects its efforts to disrupt the blockade and draw attention to the humanitarian crisis in Palestine as well as in Yemen. And the linkage between targeting vessels and ending the blockade highlights the Yemeni government's strategic objectives. And I think it has actually created a huge international uproar, and it has actually even made certain countries to actually back off a little bit, because it is going to affect trade and economics, you know, tremendously. So again, it was a huge wake up and a huge effort from Yemen. And I think that that was quite brave, and for that to continue in a way did actually wake up the international community a little bit more than they expected to actually respond.
And to end the program, the ceasefire talks, I believe, is a good way to put into a question to you, Sudden Emmer. What is going on there? At this point, it is maybe becoming a reality that the camp that says Netanyahu doesn't want a solution because that would mean the end of his political career. Do you think that that's true?
Exactly. That's very much true. He knows that the moment that the ceasefire and stop the war, it means the defeat of Israel in its war against Gaza, providing that they said from the very beginning that they are going to eliminate Hamas and the Palestinian resistance and to release all the prisoners, and they failed in doing that. So it is a victory to the Palestinians, and it is the second victory after the 7th of October. This is on the one hand. So Netanyahu, he don't want to stop the war, and he don't want to go to any kind of deal with the negotiations, and he continued to put obstacles in front of this negotiations in order to make the war longer and longer, and he don't care about the prisoners. In spite of the fact of these demonstrations going on in Israel by the families of these prisoners, still Netanyahu, he prefers his own personal interest rather than the interest of Israel. All the parties in Israel are pressurizing also for these negotiations, including the not only the opposition, but also in his government. But yet, the other side of his government, the right wing, like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they are, you know, encouraging him to go on with the war and not to go for these negotiations. And Smotrich, he said it, I don't care about the prisoners, I care about occupying Gaza.
Thank you very much, Sadat Nimr, Professor of Political Science, Brzezet University, from Occupied Ramallah. And Fahima Mohammed, thank you so much, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray protesters on pro-Palestinian marches as extremist and outrageous and dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. British ministers are considering proposals to ban MPs and councillors from engaging with groups such as the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Extinction Rebellion, and Just Stop Oil. The plans put forward by the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, say mainstream political leaders should tell their representatives to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop hate on marches. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, are due to discuss the proposals as part of a review conducted by Woodcock, the former Labour MP who now sits as Lord Walney, a crossbench peer. The Prime Minister was condemned by human rights groups for warning of forces trying to tear us apart during a hastily arranged address in Downing Street recently. He was charged with exaggerating tensions at protests after he warned of mob rule in Britain. In an article in the Sun newspaper, Lord Walney wrote, "My review on political violence is about to be formally submitted to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary. In it, I'm asking the leader of every mainstream political party to take a zero-tolerance approach to the threat that is threatening our democracy." Lord Walney added, "So Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer should instruct their MPs and councillors not to engage with anyone from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign until they get their house in order and cut the hate from their marches." The proposals are politically convenient for the government because, if accepted, they would put further pressure on the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, over his party's stance on pro-Palestine demonstrations. Several sitting Labour MPs have attended Palestine Solidarity Campaign events, including the former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, and the MP for Poplar and Limehouse, Absana Begum. Labour has refused to suspend MPs who have attended events despite demands from senior Tories because the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is not a proscribed organisation. The Conservatives have previously engaged in talks with Extinction Rebellion, including the Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove, whose department is working on the definition of extremism as part of its brief. Ministers are looking at broadening the new definition to cover groups that officials claim their actions undermine the UK's institutions, as previously reported by The Guardian. While Environment Secretary in 2019, Michael Gove met Extinction Rebellion and said afterwards he shared their high ideals to tackle the climate crisis. Labour leader Keir Starmer is already under pressure to allow Labour representatives more freedom to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza. after George Galloway's emphatic by-election victory in Rochdale, where 18% of the population is Muslim. Many within the Labour Party believe it points to anger felt by Muslims over the party's position on Israel. A shadow frontbencher questioned whether the Labour leadership had gone far enough in dispelling false narratives on pro-Palestine marches. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray pro-Palestine protesters as extremists and dangerous and outrageous. Dame Sarah Khan, who is carrying out a review of the resilience of the UK's democracy for Michael Gove, said such claims risk further dividing the country. Hundreds of thousands of people have been regularly massing on the streets of London to protest against the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli regime. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has described the demonstrations as hate marches, and the government's Commissioner for Counter-Extremism, Robin Simcox, wrote in the Daily Telegraph recently that London had been permitted to be turned into a no-go zone for Jews every weekend. Speaking to the Daily Mail, before Robin Simcox's comments were published, Dame Sarah Khan said she believed the United Kingdom had a problem with extremism, but that people should be careful in their language. Dame Sarah Khan, who was Simcox's predecessor as the government's counter-extremism commissioner, said, "I think it is really important that we don't conflate those protesters, somehow saying or portraying them as somehow as being all extremists." She added, "What I've been really uncomfortable with over the last couple of weeks is a kind of argument that they're extremists on these demonstrations. I think that's actually outrageous." Dame Sarah Khan was appointed as an independent advisor for social cohesion and resilience in 2022 and is expected to complete her review this month. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has not gone as far as some within the Conservative Party in criticising the marches in London, but he has recently warned against the protests. Jonathan Hall, KC, the government's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, warned, however, against attempts to curtail freedom of expression and freedom of assembly on the basis that it might make some parts of society unhappy. Every week, tens of thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators protest in Britain, condemning Israeli crimes in Gaza. Recently, hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestine protesters staged a fresh march against Israeli crimes in London, demanding a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The demonstration, which was organized by UK-based advocacy and Palestine action groups, was one of the biggest pro-Palestinian marches held in London. The procession followed the main roads in central London to reach the Israeli embassy. The protesters responded to calls for a third global action day for Gaza, demanding world leaders take immediate action to stop the massacring of innocent civilians in Gaza. Demonstrators held placards reading "Ceasefire Now," "Free Palestine," and stop the genocide. Around 1,500 police officers have been patrolling the area and are said to be keeping marchers away from the Israeli embassy in London. The British Law Enforcement Agency claimed a demonstrator who was seen in the crowd with a placard was arrested for inciting racial hatred. Police officers then made 10 further arrests during the incident at Hyde Park Corner, bringing the total number of those arrested to 11. A number of further restrictions are being implemented by police during the protest. Meanwhile, similar marches were also held in other major cities across Europe, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader says the massacre of women and children in Gaza proves Israel is incapable of defeating the resistance despite the West's all-out support. More than 140 Christian leaders call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, urging the U.S. and its allies to stop supplying arms to Israel. And the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement describes Israel's crimes in Gaza as a stain on humanity.